It's time for TWiT This Week in Tech. Andy Anatko is here. Renee Ritchie is here as well. And we've also got Jeff John Roberts of Fortune fame. We're going to be talking about Apple's control freakery, Google's spam filtering, Reddit's old CEO, former CEO, I should say, and Amazon's best product ever. It's all coming up next on TWiT.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiT, This Week in Tech, episode 518, recorded Sunday, July 12th, 2015. Apple Samsunged the BBC. This Week in Tech is brought to you by Carbonite. The hands-on business owner, Carbonite makes data backup hands-free. Carbonite's automatic cloud backup provides you with round-the-clock protection at work and at home. Visit Carbonite.com and use the offer code TWIT for two free bonus months. And by Stamps.com. Start using your time more effectively with Stamps.com. Use Stamps.com to buy and print real U.S. postage the instant you need it right from your desk. To get our special offer, go to Stamps.com now, click on the microphone, and enter TWIT. That's Stamps.com. Enter TWIT. And by Audible.com. Sign up for the Platinum Plan and get two free books. Go to Audible.com/TWIT2. Follow Audible on Twitter. User ID, Audible_com. And by Braintree. If you're working on a mobile app and searching for a simple payment solution, check out Braintree. With one simple integration, you can offer your customers every way to pay. Period. To learn more and for your first $50,000 in transactions fee-free, go to BraintreePayments.com/TWIT. It's time for TWIT This Week in Tech, the show where we talk about the tech news with some of the most brilliant and interesting minds in technology. We've got some great minds for you here today. My name is Mike Elgin. I'm TWIT's news director, and I'm subbing for Leo, who's, do we even know where Leo is? I think he's still in Europe. We don't know. He's
floating around on a boat somewhere.
Yeah, he's on a boat. We got a great, great panel for you today. Some of my favorite people to interview and to have on as panels, lists, and so on. Starting with Andy Anatko, technology columnist for the Chicago Sun-Times, host of MacBreak Weekly, and so much more. Welcome to you, Andy Anatko.
It is nice to be welcomed by you on this Sunday.
I really appreciate you coming on. And speaking of MacBreak Weekly, we also have Renee Ritchie, editor-in-chief of iMore, co-host of MacBreak Weekly, and a whole bunch more. Welcome to you, Renee Ritchie.
It feels like an invasion, Mike, but it's really not what we intended. We're here more as friendly ambassadors.
Exactly. We come from the world of Apple to spread. No, we're going to find out what Renee Ritchie thinks of Android, I think, at some point during this show. So that'll be really great. And also, one of my favorite interview guests for Tech News today, Jeff John Roberts, who writes about law, culture, and technology and politics for Fortune. Welcome to you, Jeff.
Hi, Mike. Good to be here.
I'm so glad you're here. Now, how did you land the sort of law, culture, and technology beat at all the places you've written? Like, do you have a particular background in law, for example?
Yeah, I'm a recovering lawyer. So when I wanted to make my way into journalism, I liked tech, and I had the legal shtick. So this is where I landed.
Yeah, you
can. Go ahead.
You write with a conspicuous knowledge of the subject, and I suspect that as much. But as you were saying.
Yeah, I can't really. I don't have the same chops on Apple as your other guests, but if they're getting sued, I'll weigh in. Otherwise, I'm going to sit back and enjoy hearing who's really better, Apple or Android. So,
great, 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 great. So I promised for those of you, and we do have lots of folks in our audience who just don't want to hear that much about Apple. We're going to talk about Apple. We're going to start with Apple. But I promise this isn't going to be the Apple show. We're going to talk about a couple of stories that Apple's been involved with. Then we're going to move to other stories as well. But let's start with a really interesting bit of news that came out this week, which is that Apple plans to sell third-party products in their stores, but only if they get to help design the boxes. In other words, they're going for uniformity in the appearance of Apple boxes of third-party products and accessories and stuff like that in their stores. Andy Anatko, is their control freakery finally gotten out of hand completely? What's going on here?
as usual, this is fodder for really great discussion the week of the announcement. And then a year later, we realized we didn't really notice anything. Basically, it's part of their made for iPhone program, where if they want to get certified, part of it is now they have to have input into packaging. Now that's also extending to use in the stores. And what it looks like, according to people who've had access to the new packaging, is that we're talking about Apple sort of stuff, which is white boxes, simple typography, probably also focus on recyclable materials. And it's probably there. It also will help out Apple a lot to make sure that they can rack things the way they like to have a nice, clean, uncluttered appearance. And also, it's safe, given that Apple mall stores are heavy on having human meat inside there, not much space for actual other products. It's good for them to say, why don't we get you guys to create packaging that we can efficiently store, efficiently stack, and efficiently display. It does. I think Apple is now beyond the point of caring if people think that they're control freaks or not, because I mean, at some point they're going to say, we love this new phone charger you've made. We're not wild about the serifs on the logo in your company. Now, we can hook you up with somebody.
Right. I know a designer, Rene Ritchie. You know, this is this, you know, Apple as well as anybody. And you know sort of like how they think about things. They're apparently also going to be reducing the number of third-party products that are available in stores. So in addition to giving a helping hand with the designs of the packaging, they're also going to be sort of consolidating down and selling fewer things. Are they going to be strong-arming companies and tell them things like, if you want to be one of those coveted, get one of those coveted spots in the Apple store, we're going to need you to be exclusive in this way and to have your price be that way? Are they going to be dictating terms for the companies that are lucky enough to be in Apple stores?
I mean, we've had this before with Target and Walmart and Best Buy, who get exclusive versions of this or that release and exclusive products. It's not by any means rare in the retail world. I would just argue that often Apple's incentives are different than a lot of other companies. And what's really interesting is, like, for example, Apple cares about the opening and the packaging experience. They want you to be able to pick up a plug, pull this little plastic tab, and the whole thing just opens up in front of you, where other packaging, you can get a jackhammer and barely make a dent in it, and your frustration level soars. So it's sort of those things that they really care about. And as you mentioned, they're going to reduce the amount of products in there. So they want to make the ones that they have in the store sort of really fit their principles, which is the recyclability, which is the minimalism. And that sort of thing is absolutely controlling. But when you look at it, it's the sort of things that Apple doesn't control that often annoy us more, like AT&T's signal quality or FedEx's delivery schedule, or trying to open that iPhone case package that we bought at the Apple store and isn't as easy to open. So yes, it's absolutely controlling. No, it's not really different than what any other major retailer does. It's just the things that Apple cares about because they have so much money and so much power, and user experience is higher on their list than it is, you know, some other retailers or manufacturers, because they can afford to have it higher on the list and it's a priority for them. It remains to be seen. I think it will be a consumer benefit, and we'll have to see if the lack of sort of, if it's too much of a burden for manufacturers, or the lack of variety is a detriment.
Well, speaking of Apple's money and power, apparently the FTC is exploring Apple rules for streaming music rivals in the Apple Store. Apparently the 30% cut that they take for streaming music subscriptions, if you buy that from the app, in most cases you don't have to buy it in the app, but people don't know that. They don't know you can go to the website, Spotify or whatever, and sign up. But if you sign up for a subscription in the app, Apple gets a chunk of that. And that creates a problem for their competitors. Now that Apple has Apple Music, they're at a kind of the competitors to Apple Music are at a disadvantage because they have to pay Apple. That means they can either raise their prices so that they're cost more than $9.99, more than Apple Music, or they can lose money or make less money and so on. Jeff John Roberts, do you think that this sort of investigation or whatever has merit? Is Apple going to be prevented from charging what they charge for streaming music downloads on, you know, get the 30% cut?
I really doubt it. I was a little puzzled by this because I think the regulators might be on their high horse a bit, because to prove antitrust in America, at least, you have to show harm to consumers, not harm to competitors. While this does hurt Spotify and stuff, Apple's not the only game in town. You can also get Spotify through Google Play and from the website. And the only other reason you can sort of go after them is for deceptive or unfair trade practices. And I don't see how this is that, because Apple has always done this. Everyone knows it, and you know, news publishers, anything else. This is how Apple's always operated. So I'm a little puzzled.
We're having some audio problems on your audio, Jeff.
Yeah, I think he's covering up the mic with his hands, possibly.
Yeah. Okay, so we'll figure that out. Andy or Richie, you guys have any comments on this, do you think?
There's one thing that from the people have been confused by this from the start, and it seems blatantly unfair on the surface. But one of the things that I try to do is look at repercussions. So when Apple moved to the agency model and when they started doing things like in-app purchases and having web subscription services, one of the problems with this is if there is no fee or even a reduced fee, it incentivizes companies to move transactions out of the App Store. So for example, if Apple only took a cut of paid apps, then almost any app maker who could would switch to in-app purchases because they would have to give no money to Apple. If they didn't take a cut of subscriptions, even if they were web-based, almost every merchant who could would switch to web-based subscriptions or subscriptions in-app that didn't have a cut. So the actual money that Apple made from the App Store would plummet. Now, Apple's a rich company, so maybe they don't need this money. But when you think about free-to-play games, for example, Candy Crush or Clash of Clans, Apple gets no money off the purchase of those games because they're free. But those games make millions of dollars through in-app purchases. Netflix is a different model. And to be clear, they don't make money off actual physical goods. Like if you order something from Amazon, there's no price sharing. It's just digital goods. But we're moving to a new age where there are so many subscription services and there are things that maybe, like we heard rumors in the TV industry, they'll have to negotiate a different rate because there really isn't a lot of room for multiple middlemen. You can have Amazon in the middle or Apple in the middle or Netflix in the middle, but having multiple of them, there starts to not be enough money to go around.
Yeah, but this is another one of these sort of consumer-facing problems. There's so many apps, like the Comixology app, like the Amazon app, that are so much harder to use on iOS than they are on Android, because in Android, you can simply press a button and buy whatever you want within the app. And the idea that every one of these businesses has enough profit in every purchase to be able to hand over 30% of everything to Apple for reasons that are kind of dubious. I mean, it's kind of hard to justify in the case of Comixology that Apple is helping Comixology to sell comics, given that they're having nothing to do with the store experience. I really think this is something that Apple's going to need to revisit. And I really think that at least the idea of taking 30% off of every app and forcing app makers to really drive consumers out of this really nice store experience and into a website, I really think they're going to have to revisit that, because it really is making iOS devices much more difficult to use.
Well, and again, this is still all under the umbrella of Apple's wealth and power. And I think the biggest example of that I've ever seen was a story that hit the Wall Street Journal today. And the story basically is that Apple's share of the industry profits for the smartphone have risen from 65% in the first quarter of last year to 92% for the first quarter of this year. Apple, one company, is making 92% of the industry's profits. This is incredible. How do they do it, Rene Ritchie?
They made a bigger screen phone. I mean, yeah. If you look at the 65% was because Apple only made phones that were 4 inches and under, and all the remaining profit industry was mostly made by Samsung, who offered larger than 4-inch phones. And that meant that the minute Apple made a larger than 4-inch phone, they were going to take profit away from Samsung. Might have been 1%, might have been significantly more. It turns out it's significantly more, and Apple is now selling a lot of premium phones. They also completely avoid the budget phone or the low-end phone market, which can be break even, can be minimally profitable. But when you look at most of Apple's competitors, even Samsung now, which we'll talk about later, they're not making any money. So the combination of Apple exclusively focusing on the premium market and the intelligence of Tim Cook and Jeff Williams and the operations team, frankly, with their supply chain logistics, makes just those phones incredibly profitable for Apple.
Yeah, there's also the fact that although iOS, the iPhone is only about, 17% of the phone market right now, there's only one place you can get them. So it's very easy to basically, if you're taking a percentage of every single phone made for a certain operating system, that also has a role to play. Also, the fact that, as Renee said, they're not interested in making phones that are not profitable, which is kind of sad, because it means that there's a reason why at almost every Apple keynote, China. Let's talk about China. Look at our China store. Hey, look, this is going to be available in China very quickly. They're not going to talk about the countries in Africa. They're not going to talk about India. They're not going to talk about Pakistan because those people are not buying premium phones. So it's an issue. I mean, it's great that they're making that they're so profitable. I don't begrudge them for that. But to me, that's just a trivia number. It doesn't have any bearing on what people should do with their phones.
Andy, do you think they're going to be able to maintain their China strategy? I mean, I think that China's smartphone market is kind of plateauing to a certain extent. And we also know that Xiaomi and other Chinese companies are very, very good at offering the Chinese consumers what they want. And it just seems like a big part of their more recent surge toward these kinds of numbers, 92% profits and other numbers, the fact that they're going to be building up to 90 million phones this year for their next iPhone device, the line, was because they were struggling in China for a long time. I mean, they didn't have the China Mobile as a carrier, even though lots of people were bringing phones into China Mobile. There were other problems as well in China. And finally, after really chipping away at China for years, they finally got it right, and now they're huge in China. They're building Apple stores as fast as they can in China. But is that – so that's a change from not really doing China right to now doing it right. Is it going to plateau, or do you think that they can sort of keep up this kind of success rate in China?
I think that's largely a Chinese how good is the Chinese financial situation right now? One of the things that makes them so attractive is that a lot of people with a lot of money and the willingness to make sure other people know that they have a lot of money. And one way to express that is, I've got this really exotic luxury premium brand phone. Xiaomi is doing incredible. There's also a certain point of pride thing going on, in that this is sort of this is not the thing that came from over there. This is the thing that was produced over here to one extent or another. But it will never be the sort of premium luxury Western good that Apple is. I've been wondering if their difficulty in getting into China was part of what's helped them out, because it did become this exotic brand. You had to know somebody to have an Apple phone before they started getting into China. And I think that's one of the reasons why, if you went to one of the Chinese counterfeit markets in a major Chinese city, you would see just like booth after booth with Chinese knockoff phones of iPhones. Not just the ones that are perfect copies of the iPhone 3 and the iPhone 4 and that sort of stuff. I'm talking about like flip phones that have an illuminated Apple logo on the back, where it's not about fooling people into thinking you have an iPhone. It's that I've got something with this beautiful luxury brand logo on it that I would like to associate myself with. I don't think that they're going to find the bottom of that well anytime soon, but I do think there's going to have to be a time where, for one of several reasons, they're going to have to start making phones for people who do not have an almost unlimited supply of money to spend on luxury goods.
To Andy's point, I mean, when Tim Cook was talking about the amount of people switching from Android to iPhone, a lot of that was in China. And I forget who posted the numbers. But when you saw how many people were planning to switch from iPhone to Android, it was single digit. But to switching from Android to iPhone was high double digits. And that was what Apple was using to sort of build out their strategy for China, is that there are still a lot of people who may not make the iPhone their first phone, but want to make it their next phone.
Great point. Well, we got a whole bunch of great stories coming up in just a sec, but first let's take a break and let's talk about backup. One of the fundamental laws of reality for anyone who uses a computer is that you have to not only back up your data, but you have to back it up in the cloud. Lots of people, we've all heard the stories about somebody who backed up locally on a local hard drive. Everything got damaged or stolen or whatever, and they lost everything. And I think I doubt that anybody watching this program has ever gotten through to this point in their life without losing some data in one way or another. Carbonite is the leading way and the best way and the easiest way to back up to the cloud. And here's why. You install it and it intelligently goes right to work backing up your files. You can go in and fine tune it. It's very smart about identifying which are your data files and which are files you don't need to back up, things that are associated with applications and so on. And then you just basically can go in there and tweak it and say, you know what, I don't want to back up this folder. I don't want to back up these two files in this folder. I do want to back up this other folder, and I even want to back up this application folder and everything in it. And you can just fine-tune exactly what gets backed up. And then it keeps you notified of what's going on with your backup. It'll tell you, for example, that you haven't backed up in a while, if there's some kind of glitch. If you want to pause the backup, it's on a little tiny icon at the top of your screen. You just tap on that and say, you know what, pause this for 24 hours. Instantly, it pauses, and then you don't have that process running, even though it's such a light process, generally speaking. But if you don't want to be using your internet connection for backing up or whatever, you can do that. It's such a fantastic application. You have to use Carbonite, and here's the thing with losing data. You really regret it when you didn't back up correctly. And you basically can never tell when something is going to happen where you're going to wish you had a backup. And, of course, with Carbonite, it's also very handy for you to retrieve files, because you can use the app that they offer, the mobile app, and just get access to all of your files from anywhere through your mobile device. So it's really, really great. Carbonite can protect your business, your home. No matter what you are doing with your data, you need to make sure that you back up and join the 70,000 businesses that trust Carbonite, the 1.5 million customers who trust Carbonite for round-the-clock protection of their files. Visit Carbonite.com and get 2 bonus months free when you use the offer code TWIT. So that's Carbonite.com, offer code TWIT. We thank them for their support of TWIT. Well, Google, speaking of stuff that happens in the background that's very sophisticated, Google announced this week that they are now hitting a 99.9% success rate in filtering spam. How do they do this? This is almost miraculous. In fact, for a long time, I'd mentioned this on TNT this week, they caught most of everything, and their spam filtering has always had a good reputation, but they couldn't get the Dr. Oz spams. The ones that were telling me that I was, you know, overweight and needed to change my diet and all that kind of stuff. And then 3 or 4 months ago, they just completely stopped. I haven't heard from Dr. Oz since then. What are they doing that is enabling them to have such a great success rate in catching spam? I'll open that up to the group.
Well, I think they're certainly well motivated, because they said, you don't get to send ads to our users. Only we get to send ads to our users. but this is another example of why Google is in a unique position to create services that work really, really well for its users, by virtue of the fact of how many users Google actually has and how much of their behavior they can actually observe. It's not only deep neural thinking that they've got, the deep nets that they've started making a high marquee feature of every Google product. It's always been there, but now they're willing to say, here's why we can get things working, because we have a deep machine learning understanding of the world around us. But also, they can look at the behavior of other users and how they are reacting to some of the mail that they're getting, and use that experience to apply it to others. And so it's pretty much as simple as that. You're never the third person to get a piece of spam. You're the half a millionth person to have that bounced off of their inbox.
Yeah, I think Andy's exactly right. There are certain things that Google, just as a company, based on the way they do technology and the way they think about the internet, is uniquely positioned to solve. And this is one of those problems. They have massive experience in sifting through large amounts of internet data. They have amazing algorithms, people who are programming those algorithms, and they have an incredibly large user pool, and they can watch those behaviors, and they can use heuristics, but they can also note if Andy marks something as spam, if Mike marks something as spam, if I do, more than likely spam. I'm surprised they didn't get Dr. Oz faster. Maybe they thought that was ham for a while, or maybe Mike subscribed long ago. Now that, because there's so much data going through there, and when Google talks about machine learning and they talk about neural networks, this is exactly what that's designed to solve. And I've used Gmail. I mean, I use Apple stuff, but almost all my services, Mobile Nations as a company, is all built on Google. And I've almost never seen spam in my account. It is close to miraculous.
The other thing, Jeff, that needs to be pointed out is that, spam filtering is really just, we tend to think of it as a discrete function that email cloud services provide, or that applications can provide, and so on. But in fact, this machine learning stuff is doing what Google does. It's algorithms. It's learning about you. And the thing that I find most miraculous about it, Jeff, is that it's like, that lots and lots of users are not using it right. So somebody might have subscribed to a newsletter, and then it's just easy to mark it as spam when they're done. And yet Google can figure out which, you know, it doesn't all of a sudden, you know, make this newsletter spam everywhere. So it's really fantastic. Do you have any particular anxiety or do you feel fine about this kind of, you know, filtering that's like, you know, making these decisions for you about what it's going to show you and what it doesn't show you?
Not really, because Google is so fantastically good at it. I suppose you think hard, yes, there are privacy implications or having them think for us or Google Now products. But I think as long as it's so incredibly good at doing it, it's the convenience outweighs any sort of sinister motives. In terms of my issues with Google, its anti-spam effectiveness is pretty far down the list.
Well, Google is always in the news. I love covering Google because they just generate so much news. And I actually find, I don't know how you Apple specialists do it, Renee, but because Apple basically announces a whole bunch of news all at once, and then they are just tight-lipped the rest of the year, whereas Google is throwing things out left and right, and it's much of it is newsworthy. But we've also been hearing a lot about Google Glass. I believe I'm the only glass hole on this panel. Is that correct? I like it. I believe in it.
There goes Andy.
There we go. All right. But are you an enthusiastic user, or do you have buyer's remorse?
I certainly don't have buyer's remorse. I've never been an enthusiastic user because it's always had that fundamental problem where you're said putting it away for too long. They will never get around this problem right here, which is that this is going to be how people see you when you're running into places. It means that if I'm in a public place, or better yet, a public-ish space like a restaurant, I really am going to have to take these off and put them in my bag, because even if I'm not doing anything with them, I don't want people to worry that I'm doing something with them. But I'm a great admirer of it. The times where I do use it, I'm really, really happy that I have it. And I'm also the beneficiary of Google Glass, as is pretty much everybody who uses Android Wear, because if you were using Google Glass for a year, you really saw a lot of the thinking and a lot of the experience that Google picked up from watching how people are using Glass reflected in how an Android Wear watch works. So I'm not in any way remorseful that I bought this. I do use it about a few times a month, and there are some circumstances when I'm being a tourist where I will take it with me because I know that this is the best way to record what I'm doing while I'm doing it.
And you do use it exclusively for photography and video?
No, it was what I loved about it was the ability to the first experience I had with it in New York after I picked it up at Google in New York was still the landmark version of this experience where I'm taking a nice long walk through Central Park. And one of the reasons why I take a nice long walk is that once you basically spin your brain completely down without any distractions, without any screens, without anything, it starts to do a deep cook of different thoughts and different questions you've had on your mind, and ideas start coming. And so the ability to simply, while you're in the middle of your walk, you have a great idea or you're reminded of something you want to take care of, and simply saying, okay, Glass, take a note, then you speak the note, and then you're without stopping, without looking at anything, without even looking at your wrist, you're on and happy. It was the first device that really taught me how much a phone distracts you. No matter how much it's helping you, it's still this thing that is still like sort of, hey, pay attention to me, hey. And so why don't we just settle that down? So yeah, I'm very happy that I have it.
Great. Well, the news that actually happened this week is a couple of things, really. One is that the FCC, it's got to be the FCC, Google entered a new product that they were kind of vague about called the GG1 that is a, you know, supports Wi-Fi and Bluetooth. And they were vague about its function, but it's clearly or very likely to be the first commercial version of Google Glass. And the second bit of news is that 9to5 Google is reporting that a Google Glass Enterprise Edition, which has a larger prism, not a smaller one, and an optional external battery pack. And this would be for, you know, businesses to use, maybe delivery drivers, people who work for Amazon, whatever. And that makes a lot of sense. Renee Ritchie, what are your thoughts on Google Glass? And also, we know, of course, we've heard the rumor that Apple would come out with an Apple Watch for a long time. Will Apple ever do another type of wearable? I don't see them ever doing Google Glass type products, but will they ever do a different wearable besides a wristwatch?
It's a fascinating thing, and I actually really like the news that Google Glass would be coming out with an enterprise edition. Maybe not enterprise specifically, but I'm going to completely rip off my colleague Georgia Dow on this, because she did a great article comparing the wearable strategies of Google and Apple, and exactly what I talked about with Gmail, where they are so smart algorithmically and in terms of machine learning. Their technology is fantastic. Their understanding of humanity is not always great. And psychologically, the original Google Glass, not a good product, because normal people, even tech journalists, because we are human beings too, walking around with Locutus of Borg on their face is just not a great experience. It sort of intermediates the human process, which is incredibly based on face and eye recognition and patterns and deeply ingrained psychology. And it wasn't careful about how to address that problem, where Apple took their time, put it on the wrist, which is, you know, Rolex and other companies fought the battle for putting technology on the wrist decades ago, and that was a slow process, but they won the wrist as well. So it was sort of an incremental increase. The face is going to take longer, but I think there's a huge opportunity, like you said, for enterprise, for people who are working on things, people who are maybe fixing cables or server rooms, who can have instructions and information presented to them, sort of like Microsoft showed off with the HoloLens. There's this fast opportunity where you are working on a technical level and not a human level. You know, I don't want to see my psychologist or my doctor wearing this while I'm talking to them. Maybe when they're operating on me, it's fine. But when I'm talking to them, I want that human interaction. But when they're fixing my car or fixing my internet connection, use all this stuff. I think it's brilliant.
Yeah. I do think it's funny.
Can I jump in for a second?
I'm sorry, Jeff, go ahead.
Yeah, I just got to be the skeptic here. And I mean, as I guess the norm on the panel, I can only see Google Glass as a complete failure. I mean, you haven't heard of it for months. And, you know, Mike, you're a fan of it. But honestly, in your heart of hearts, do you think this is going to catch on? I mean, it's cool that they can do it. But can you ever see mainstream adoption of it?
Not this. No, not even close. But I can see all kinds of everything except mainstream users use it. For example, you can see this kind of technology for people, you know, scuba diving, or you can see this kind of technology for all kinds of professionals. I also believe very much so that notifications inside of eyeglasses, whether there's a camera or not, that's another issue. But I do see notifications. Just if you can't tell that a pair of glasses has the ability to receive and
you're
display
notifications. You're getting one right now, aren't you, Mike?
Yes, I am. I am. Thank you. Yeah, and thank you for telling me that in advance before you're going to say that. No, there's a supreme irony, though, about Google Glass itself, which actually occurred to me this week, and I had never really thought of this. And the irony is this. The people who hate Google Glass hate it because there's a camera on it pointing everywhere. And the people who love Google Glass love it because of the camera. Right. And it does a million things besides the camera. But most users, that's why I asked you, Andy, whether you just use it exclusively. Most people who use Google Glass still, it's just a camera on their face that's hands-free.
Yeah, and if Google ever decided that we're going to just do, we're going to break out all the Android from this, we're just going to make it a camera with Bluetooth LE connection to your phone, I think that it would be a really popular product. But the getting back to like Renee's point, I would never have guessed that anybody with 10 micrograms of self-respect would use something that looks like a selfie stick in public. And yet it's got, in the space of just a year, it's gone from something that I only see people using outside in Boston when they are clearly tourists, usually from that look like they're from Asia, to no, it's everybody that now has them. So when you offer
but it's
somebody,
not a selfie hat, Andy, it's not a selfie hat.
No. Well, that would be even cooler. You basically created a brand new product category. You are a brand influencer, Renee. You should create this to cause this to come to market. But I think that if there were a way to get Google Glass in the form of a $100 to $150 gadget that didn't have a lot of the social baggage that were attached to it, I think it would do very well. Because when I go through my Google Photo stuff, some of the most compelling video that I shot is stuff that I would never have shot in a million years. Again, I'm a tourist. I'm not at a private function. I'm not even inside a restaurant or anything like that. I'm just taking a walk through New York City on December 22nd to see the lights at Rockefeller Center. And because I've got Google Glass on, and I do have a nice camera on my neck, but I want to be able to look at this beautiful display while, and why don't I just take a recording of this as I'm watching it? It's some of the most compelling stuff that I have in my photo roll, and I'm glad that I have it. So they definitely have something there. It definitely bears mentioning that Google never sold this as a regular product. It was always, we are being explicit here. We don't know if we've got something here yet. The only way we can figure this out is if we actually make it and then ask the people who want to get it, how are you using it? What are you liking about it? What are you not liking about it? And so on that basis, it was a very, very successful research project, especially, as I said, as it fed into what Google Wear eventually became. But it was an experiment worth doing. It's not a $1,500 gadget for most people or even more than weirdos like myself, but it's definitely worth doing.
You know, I've had a lot of arguments with my fellow journalists in technology about Google Glass over the couple of years, and it always went something like this. The complaint was always that, oh, you're like the Borg, you have the ability to record and take pictures all the time. I don't know when I'm looking at you if you're taking my picture, and I always said, no, this is the worst surveillance, secret surveillance device in history because the whole thing lights up when you're recording video. That's not a bulletproof argument because in certain conditions you can't really tell that it's recording video, but in most cases you absolutely can. And not only, if you cross the table from somebody talking, not only can you tell that the person is recording video, you can see the video. Like, you can watch it. Like, you can actually see what they see. You can see their notifications and stuff. And so I always made that point. But, the journalists, the same journalists who were so opposed to somebody recording strangers in public places seem to me to be among the most enthusiastic users of Meerkat and Periscope when these products came into the market. And they were Periscoping and Meerkatting everything in sight. And I don't know how this is better than this. I mean, it's
on top of everything else. I mean, how many times have you been on the subway and, hi, I've just listened to my music. This is the way I normally hold my phone when I'm listening to music. I'm certainly not taking your picture because you seem to have an interesting facial hair or anything like that. You know, I mean, that's a lost argument. And as you say, I mean, there's a reason why I didn't get there's a reason why I wanted to get you want to get sort of a louder color because it should be very, very obvious that, hey, look, I'm wearing a device right now and I don't want to be doing something that's sneaky.
Yeah. It's not the technology, though, so much. It really, to me, is the psychology. I wear glasses, and there was social stigma attached to glasses for a long time. People would call you Four Eyes. It's one of those things that the faces are so important to us as human beings that if my first experience with you is Mike Elgin's face, that's one thing. But if my first experience, even if I've known you, we've had dinner many times, if I see you and suddenly there's an unusual-looking piece of technology on your face, that creates a barrier between our communications. It's always something I see. It's a distraction. It's something that gets in the way of a relationship, and that's something that varies slowly through seeding programs, maybe like the Explorers program, that as a society, we have to decide is acceptable. It's not so much a camera. People have had problems with cell phone cameras. They've banned them from locker rooms. There's selfie sticks. There's what Andy was showing. All those things are fine. It's just there's a reason why in Aliens there's face huggers and not wrist huggers. It's something that is very core to our experience as human beings.
Okay, well, look,
and those sorts of things really do sort of matter to us.
The alien is not going to ram its overpositor down your wrist. Come on. Now you're talking crazy talk. Hey. But I mean, it's interesting to also think that Renee and I wear different styles of glasses. I wear this style because I like it. It was discontinued by Ray-Ban since I bought it. So now when I break these, I have to buy them off of eBay because that's how much I like these frames. It's a conscious choice that this is the sort of thing that I want to wear. It's going to be interesting when you also add, this is a conscious choice that I think enough, this technology helps me out in so many different ways that I'm willing to have this little bar right at the top there and that you're going to have to simply accept the fact that I've got this on my face. So it's part of the entire face is your user interface, including the fact that you might have facial hair, the fact that you comb your hair a certain different way, and the fact that the fact that I was self-conscious enough about the Dr. Pepper t-shirt I was wearing until an hour ago that I did actually find a clean dress shirt to put on. It really is all about your user interface, and everything you do is not necessarily good or bad, but it's a part of a conscious choice that you choose to make.
So there's another story around Google Glass, and I was actually not even intending to talk much about Google Glass today, but this is actually a very interesting topic, I think. And that element is that a lot of journalists immediately said it was dead. Like, this is, you know, as soon as Google made the announcement that they're closing the Explorer program and they're sending it, you know, to the productizing process, you know, the squirrels that run the thing that turn, you know, research projects into actual products, everybody said it was dead. The exact same announcement was made for Project Tango, which is a Google project to do indoor mapping with a mobile device. And nobody said that was dead, but they made the exact same announcement. And now, of course, Google is making noise that it's really serious about shipping something around Google Glass. Is the echo chamber too overwhelming these days in the tech press, where the tech press doesn't like something and they can basically spread this misconception? I mean, Google very specifically said, Google Glass is not dead. We are sending it over to become a real product. And then everybody said, oh, it's dead. They're killing it. They're smothering it. Is the tech press too overwhelming? I'll start with you, Jeff. Do you see examples like this and other examples where the tech press just spreads this idea that is mostly just wishful thinking?
I don't think so. I think when the tech press, sort of people involved in tech, like tech, know tech very well and better than most people, I think they have a capacity frequently to overstate things and seize onto fads, be it Allo. Who knows, maybe Meerkat and Periscope will be fads too. But I think when the tech press pronounces something over, they're usually right. I'm trying to think of an exception where something suddenly came storming back and the tech geeks were wrong. I think that's unusual. And this is an unusual panel too, because I think Google Glassophiles, or glassholes, we're allowed to say that, are a minority within tech. And I think the fact that most tech people panned Google Glass and predict its demise, I don't know. I just don't see a comeback route outside of the enterprise applications you described.
Hmm. Interesting. Well, we're going to come back with some more interesting stories. We're going to be talking about encryption. Government doesn't like it, and companies like Apple and Google want to provide it. And so there's a conflict brewing there. But first, let's talk about Stamps.com, one of our sponsors today. Stamps.com will actually save you tons of time, lots of money, and there's absolutely no reason to not use Stamps.com. You can get your mailing and shipping done right from your house, and you don't have to go to the post office and wait in line and do all the things that lots of people do for some reason. The only reason I can think of that a small business owner would actually go to the post office is because they don't know about Stamps.com. That's why I'm glad to tell you about it. This is a better way to do your mailing. You can buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter or package right from your desk. And even special postage discounts that you can't get at the post office are available to you as a Stamps.com customer. It's just a fraction of the cost of doing it the old-fashioned way. The boring way, the time-consuming way, the gas-consuming way of driving around, driving to the post office, and so on. And you just don't want to have to go to the post office. And, of course, they will send you a scale for you to weigh it, and then you print the thing, and the mail carrier will take those packages off your hands right there at your house. It's a really, really great way to interact with the post office. You know who goes to the post office and waits in long lines? Other people, not you and me. We need to use Stamps.com because it's just such a great way to go. Now, right now, you can use our promo code TWIT for this special offer. It's a no-risk trial plus a $110 bonus offer, which includes a digital scale and up to $55 free postage. So don't wait. Go to Stamps.com before you do anything else. Click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in TWIT. That's Stamps.com and enter TWIT. We thank Stamps.com for supporting the world's greatest technology show. All right. Well, there's a big conflict brewing, and this scares the living daylights out of me, because the FBI and the Department of Justice are starting to label companies like Apple and Google as threats to national security, threats to public safety, because these companies offer encryption. Of course, lots of companies offer encrypted communication, but Apple and Google are two of the big ones. And Apple and Google have every intention of continuing to provide encrypted communication. Where is we'll start with you again, Jeff. Well, we left off with you a minute ago, but we'll start with you again. Where is this headed? Do you think that the government could actually win this war and enable, force Apple and Google to provide backdoors in their communications, which law enforcement could use? And, oh, by the way, so could hackers. Where do you think this is headed?
I think if that's going to happen, we won't find out about it. There might be backdoors already, because if the FBI or the NSA forces that, that'll definitely come with the strongest gag order you've ever seen. But for now, I think there's hope for encryption. I used to feel sort of ambivalent about it, but I don't like the idea that, you know, we're not allowed to communicate in encrypted fashion. What next? Are they going to ban locks? There's all sorts of other things which people have always used to promote privacy. And in this case, I think Google and Apple are correct to stand their ground. And I think more people are becoming aware that encryption is a useful and necessary thing. So, and I love what Apple did when Tim Cook updated the iOS system to make it encryption by default. I don't know how you guys feel about that, but I think, I think the world's ready for encryption.
Yeah, it's a big deal, and I think that there's a fine line between a professional, let's say a professional law enforcement official, who's advocating policies that enable them to do their job, and on the one hand, and also things that promote what they are supposed to be doing as their job on the other. And that's convoluted, so let me explain that. Law enforcement, let's just take two things, you know, fighting crime and preventing terrorist attacks, right? Encryption does those things too. So the value of encryption is, you know, it promotes safety. It promotes public safety. It enables people to not get their stuff ripped off and have their identities stolen. And it prevents hackers, industrial espionage from China and Russia and Eastern Europe and from America, from anywhere, from coming in and stealing my company secrets, right? So there's law, and, you know, so what is the answer as it regards to encryption for law and order? Is it to give the law enforcement officials the tools they need for themselves to, catch criminals and terrorists? Or is it to give encryption, real encryption with no backdoors, to the public so that they can protect themselves? And the other thing that worries me, by the way, is that the law enforcement officials who are speaking out about this in Congress and elsewhere don't seem to be aware of the consensus among experts in technology, especially encryption experts, who say, yeah, you put that backdoor in, somebody's going to exploit it. So this there's no such thing as a golden key that only the good guys can use and that the bad guys could never use. Go ahead, Renee.
I was going to say it's amazing because it would make law enforcement's job much easier if everyone was required to provide fingerprints or DNA samples. But in many societies, we've decided that that is far too great an infringement on privacy, and we would rather law enforcement had to work harder, get warrants, and go through extra effort rather than just surrendering that information. And this seems like the technological continuation of that, where it would be much easier if there was no encryption on anything and all data just flowed completely freely and anybody could look at it, including law enforcement. But as a society, a lot of people seem to be deciding that that is the same. That's the same sort of personal information that we have historically wanted to protect. And that's not true in every country. And also, it's not true that every country has been above board and actually said to their people, these are the laws we want to enact. These are the reasons why, and we want your support in enacting them. Some of them have done them secretly or behind closed doors or in ways that's actually in conflict with the laws of the land. But it seems like we're getting to a point where and I don't know how to say this best. If you look at Twitter sometimes, there's a lot of really good InfoSec people who laugh at what the government or even pro-hacking companies consider information security. They're not particularly considered to be very good at it. The methods they use aren't considered to be very good. The holes they leave are considered to be egregious and, like you said, easily exploitable. And it seems like this is an area where you don't want people who do not deeply understand the technology sort of walking elephant-like through the room, tearing everything apart as they go.
That's absolutely true. Go ahead, Andy.
Yeah. Well, no, it's that
I've been talking to people in law enforcement at the local and the state, and sometimes even the federal level, off and on about subjects like these. I think the first time I was I reached out to, remember that community was in the late 90s, early 2000s. And most of the people I talked to have shown the same attitude, which is that they have a very, very clear mandate, which is to preserve public safety. And their attitude is that if they don't exploit every tool that is legally at their disposal to pursue that mandate, they are being shamefully derelict in their duties, which is the reason why they will do things like, well, we're going to fly helicopters with infrared cameras to see where there are heat blooms and places where there should not be heat blooms. We do not believe we need a warrant to do that because we're simply observing from a helicopter. Just like we don't believe that it is going to be illegal for us to put a GPS tracker on someone's car because essentially all it is doing is what a member of law enforcement could do if they were following this person 24 hours a day, 7 days a week across all kinds of terrain without being seen. But they look for guidance. Again, this is only according to the impression I get from people I've been talking to. They look for guidance from the law. That once the law says you can't do that, they say, okay, we won't do that anymore. They're sort of going to lobby to be able to do what they think they need to do. But the best way for us to tell law enforcement to knock something off is for us to tell them to knock it off. And it's not as though they are always in this position of always trying to abrade more and more of our security and our freedoms. There was a really top secret, in the sense that we got details of it later from reporters in England in mid-May, I think, in which the security people and the legal people from Google and Apple and government agencies and all kinds of other corporations and all kinds of other citizens groups basically got together to talk about these issues in a very structured way. And one of the things that came out of that, according to some of these reports, is that there was an acknowledgement that the Edward Snowden leaks, as bad as they were for the NSA and other agencies, it was sort of a wake-up call to a lot of these agencies, saying that we can't do our job if people think that we are putting a bug. We're turning every single phone in every pocket into a bug. We need to be more open. We need to be more transparent. And more importantly, we need to make sure we don't lull ourselves into a sense where just because we can do something means that we should do something and that we need to have the right to do something. So I feel optimism here. Although, once again, it is our responsibility to tell our people who keep us safe that here is what the parameters of your job are. And we can't just, even if the lawmakers try to slip something into free lunch programs for lower income school children. And by the way, page 1008 of this bill is that we can basically, every light bulb is now a wide surveillance network. Yeah, maybe not.
Think of the children. We need the surveillance network. Yeah, and of course, I'm with you, Andy. And of course, I don't think there's room for panic except for the point that Jeff made, which is that, yes, I think we can tell the FBI no. I think we can tell the Department of Justice no. I'm not sure we'll be given the choice or the chance to tell the NSA no. And so I hope that the Snowden revelations and all the fallout that's taken place since then has made the executive branch of government more skittish about allowing stuff like this. But again, I think Jeff has a great point that this may happen under gag orders and all the rest.
It's for sure that the public's reaction to the Snowden leaks were, oh my God, this horrible spy is undermining American security. It's like, holy crap, we had no idea the government was doing this to us. We have to make them stop. So that's where my good humor about this comes from.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Ellen Pao, she resigned this week, or was fired, or both. And she was, of course, the interim CEO of Reddit. I think we've all heard the stories. Essentially, she was at Kleiner Perkins. She left. She sued them for sexual harassment and other things. She ended up being the interim CEO of Reddit. And she has not been popular with a lot of the Reddit moderators and other active users. And she inevitably, I think, left. What was the mistake that was? I think there was a mistake here made by Reddit, but I'd like to open this up to the group. What do you guys think their mistake was in all of this?
I'd like to jump on that, and that you showed that New York Times headline I was kind of perplexed by that Times story, in that that headline screamed that this was a case of sexism and persecution and so on. That story never reported why she was thrown out in the first place. I think an incredible amount of vitriol and sexism and racism poured out around her. There was also the case that a lot of people like, wait a minute, they put the wrong person in there to do this job, and they tried to commercialize Reddit in a clumsy fashion. So that was just before delving into the deeper parts of it. I was very puzzled and perplexed on how the New York Times framed that. It would have been fair to do that as analysis after, but I'd like to sort of dwell and find out why was she fired in the first place, or why did she resign, I should say.
The other inaccurate thing is, they basically point out that she fell victim to a crowd demanding her ouster. She was interim CEO. In order for her to remain in that job, they would have had to actually hire her. And usually interim CEOs are not the ones that get hired for the permanent position. So I thought that was a little bit much, too. Renee, you had a point?
Yeah, no, I was just going to say there's a lot of conflation in that story. But Reddit is an interesting company in that they have a company and a community that are loosely coupled. There's no direct control over that community. That community is mostly run by volunteer moderators and by the community itself. And then there's this business on top of it that's trying to figure out how to make money off of all of this. But they, like several other companies in recent history, have shown very little understanding of the dynamics involved in a community. And it looks like the board, you often go back to the board, and I think Chuck made a good point in the articles in the show notes for that too, that it's similar to HP, where they hired Leo Apotheker almost without even talking to him first. Yeah. And I'm sure they spoke to Ellen Powell, but it just seems like the way the business was run after having her as interim CEO had very little in terms of savvy understanding or strategic preparedness for running a community like Reddit. She engaged not with the community at all, as far as has been reported, but mostly with other business units and with media and with stakeholders who were entirely divorced from a community site like Reddit. And these things, I mean, Reddit is huge, but Dig used to be huge and Slashdot used to be huge, and communities are migratory, and they are almost like this magical thing that bubbles up when you have the sufficient ingredients. And that's highly volatile. And this just, it did not look like a successful match was made here at all.
Yeah, it was also kind of curious when you saw her official release on why she left. One of them being that the owners of the corporate owners base were demanding that she create new levels of user increase the user base by a certain percent, and that goal was not met. Which in and of itself is like, wow, you're basically creating a situation where someone has to grow an online community that's sole strength is people being attracted to it, not being pushed into it. I have to admit that this was a story where I kept trying to dig more and more and read more and more about it to understand exactly where the failure points were. The only thing that's easy to understand is that once there was blood in the water, hey, female CEO, let's go get her, which I don't think is the tone of Reddit overall. But unfortunately, there is that percentage that all you got to do is point someone toward that target, and that target will then decide that this is not worth it. It becomes a challenge for that person to execute the duties of their job. And it's just a long list of sad tales that are around this story, of some of which are commercial, some of which are based on investors, some of which are about the nature of communities to simply form around whatever locus that community has decided is going to be the meeting point. And unfortunately, there is sexism mixed in there, too.
There certainly is. And of course, one of the websites that have benefited greatly from all the controversy around Reddit and also the banning of, I think it was 8 subreddits recently. Ellen Powell did that as well. Banning subreddits that were fomenting physical threats of violence, actually. They weren't shutting down offensive things. There are many, many offensive subreddits mm-hmm. still on Reddit. But lots of people said, okay, I don't want to be in a site where there's censorship, so I'm going to go to Vote. I believe it is. It's VOAT. Is that how you say it? Have any of you tried this website, this Reddit alternative?
I never heard of it till I think Addy at The Verge or somewhere wrote a good piece on it. But I think she qualified and said there's not that many people on it. If you really want a forum to make fun of fat people or colored people or something, I guess that's where you can go. But there's always going to be these dark corners of the internet. And I think it's getting its sort of 5 minutes of fame, but I'm not sure it's really going to catch on as a mainstream thing. Although I think it was, as someone just said, online communities are migratory, and it will be interesting if we see a dig-style effect and everyone going somewhere else. Will it be vote? I'd be surprised. But I guess there's an opportunity now if someone can get that critical mass to migrate. That'll be really interesting.
Yeah. It's also interesting to me that Victoria Taylor was one of the instigating events for this. Like, there were other reasons, but Victoria Taylor's firing was one of the precipitating events for this. And she's also female, and the community's really rallied around her. So there's absolutely all forms of diversity problems in online communities. But to me, like, I don't know how much the board uses Reddit. I don't know how much Ellen Powell uses Reddit. Maybe a lot, but based on the behavior, it doesn't seem like that much. And it's hard to imagine a company where, you know, Steve Jobs doesn't use the iPhone or Larry Page doesn't use Google search. And unless you have people who are deeply enmeshed in the product that you're making, there's always going to be incredible room for things like this to happen. And I think in order for there to be change, it can't just be an interim CEO. It has to be a board and a CEO who is a deeply part of this community, understands it at a very deep level.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, there's a saying that's usually used to complain about ineffective politicians, but it's actually spot on for how best to lead a group like Reddit. The saying goes, as, oh, there go my people. I must find out where they're going so that I can lead them. If you you basically have to let people do what they're going to want to do, and the shape that group forms will tell you what kind of container you need to build for them to both help them make this place that they've discovered into something that's even more tuned to their needs, and also, of course, steer it towards a way that you can actually make money for yourself and for your investors. The problem is that a site like Reddit is going to be hitting its head against harder and harder walls as it goes, because the reason why it got as big and as useful and as attractive as it was because it really was any topic. You can create a subreddit about it. You can create a discussion forum, and you can attract like-minded people toward it with not a whole lot of oversight, which means that a lot of the most evil forums of communication were in some of these Reddit subgroups. And it gets to the point where if you want to, you no longer have the ability to say, you know what? I really have a problem with my company helping people discuss how we should shame a certain group of people into hating themselves and doing themselves harm. I think that of all the three, I'm really cool with the Marvel Comics subreddit, the subreddit about Moto 360. Great, love it. But let's see if we can not be responsible for hate groups and for people who are doing just really, really awful things. But then you don't have the ability to really do that anymore, because it's just not the nature of it's not the shape of the container that you have built. And by the time you want to start to inflict some order and control and improve your service that way, you're changing it and sort of tearing it apart. And basically, you're sending people out to find some other place to go. So I really don't know what the answer to that is. I mean, I think that what most people want, the people who are most valuable as users want, is moderation. They want a certain amount of they want to enter into a place where they know that there's a certain degree of safety and security. And sites like Reddit are going to have a harder time creating that environment for those users.
And one of the places where they may have gone is over to The Verge. Verge had a bad experience. And on July 6th, Editor-in-Chief Nilay Patel announced that they were shutting off comments on stories. They kept their forums open, but their comments on stories were being shut down temporarily while they regroup, and they're going to come back and have them be selectively on and so on. In any event, this reminds me of Popular Science, which shut down comments a few years ago. Lots of places have turned off comments because trolls and haters and racists and sexists and all kinds of people who are, say, really horrible things, people making threats and so on, you know, ruin it for everybody. And what do you think about their decision? We'll start with you, Jeff. What do you think about their decision to shut off comments? Was that the right response to a horrible week of trolling?
I get it, because as a journalist, there's two contradictory instructions. It's like, make it a good community, make people happy, make it nice. And then it's also like, engage people, engage your audience. But you start engaging, you can't have those without the trolls. They'll find you, they'll get in there. And it becomes a question of resources. I mean, suppose you can have 10 people. How many are you going to allocate to taming the trolls? It might be one people, two people. At a certain point, it gets expensive. It gets, you know, exasperating and exhausting. And then it's just easier to go, okay, enough of this, let's pull the plug. And I think that's probably what The Verge is doing right now.
Andy, what do you think? Is this are we going to see even more of this coming out? Because, again, every time you shut off an avenue for trolls, those remaining trolls will find another place, which makes that other place worse, which causes a new crisis at that other place. What do you think? Where do you think this is going in terms of a phenomenon online?
I think that we're going to find that a lot of people who are responsible for creating content are no longer going to want to be responsible for creating the forums where people talk about that content. There are a lot of journalists who feel as though that is a critical part of what makes online publication so important, that you not only do your reporting or do your editorial, but you also have a conversation with those people who are reading it. That's great, and that's a great principle, but you have time to create new journalism, or you have time to moderate this, what can be a very, very active and very, very contentious place. And like I was saying a minute ago, you don't want to be responsible for creating a place where people can say, any fat chicks should just go kill themselves right now. I can't stand those blankety blanks who live in this part of the country. They're all, and I think they should all shoot themselves right now. You can't delete those comments fast enough, and you're shocked that those things were up for even the 15 minutes while you were trying to copy edit and post something brand new. It's such a simple solution to simply go into WordPress, flip one switch, and turn off comments. And now your life gets so much easier and so much better. And if somebody complains about it, you can say, here is my Twitter handle. By all means, direct comments to me on Twitter, or here are any other places online where you can create your own board for discussion or participate in here. I'm perfectly okay with seeing people saying whatever they want to say, wherever they want to say it, but I don't have to keep the lights on in the room where they get to say that sort of stuff. Before I turned off comments on my own blog, I used to have a saying that I love the First Amendment. I love freedom of speech so much that I purchased exclusive rights to freedom of speech on anotgo.com. And yeah, you are welcome to also purchase exclusive rights to freedom of speech on your own forum, because that's God bless America.
Yeah, exactly. And Renee Ritchie, is anonymity the problem here?
Yeah, so I'll just preface this by saying that we have both forums and comments on iMore. We've got about 10 million monthly readers on iMore, about 37 million on Mobile Nations. And we believe deeply in the comment system because my bosses, they grew up making mobile communities. In fact, our titles originally were community editors before we got all, you know, journalistic about it. It was really an online community that's grown up all the content that we've made. So whenever anyone mentions we should turn off the comments, they all get almost like a visceral defensive nature about it. And we have a lot of moderators and a lot of volunteers and a lot of paid employees who spend a lot of time sort of policing is the wrong word, but sort of making sure it's a good experience, because you could have a great article and someone lands on that article and they, you know, it's beneficial for them to read it, but then you hit the comments and it's a cesspool and it makes them actually not sort of makes the entire experience a negative for them. And we're really conscious about this. But I think a large part of it is what you've said. There is that greater internet FWOD theory, that anonymity plus internet equals a troll or whatever you want to call them. But we've seen that when people have Facebook comments on, which do theoretically link to real names, or Google Plus comments that do theoretically link to real names, it doesn't really mitigate the behavior. People seem to believe that when they're disconnected, when they're through a monitor, that humanity no longer exists. And when you do remind them of it, sometimes they're contrite about it, sometimes they're not, but there's always someone else who's just coming on, who's angry or upset about something, and spewing into the comments is a very easy thing to do. So every time I see, like, during Fireball, never had comments. I remember Engadget turned theirs off. The Verge is turning theirs off for a while now. I think about it, and part of me thinks it's a great solution for every reason that Andy mentioned. And part of me just laments that there are so many wonderful aspects of the internet that we are increasingly turning off just because people routinely misuse them. And I don't know if there's an easy solution to that.
Yeah, I keep thinking about that. I think in the past 10 years, I can only think of one site that had a beautiful comment system where there were going to be at least a couple hundred comments on every single one, and almost every single one had something thoughtful and positive to say.
Google Plus.
And the author of the post was having was having an ongoing ongoing conversation that was also beautiful, and that is RogerEbert.com. And that was Roger specifically investing so much of his heart and so much of his faith in that the people who are coming to him to read his stuff on his site are not going to be jerks. And I have close knowledge of how that process went, and there was very little moderation needed because for some reason, you would see this—you would see this—the Sistine Chapel ceiling, and you have the can of spray paint in your hand, and you say, "I don't think I can find another place to spray paint a penis than this wall. I'll find some place else where it wouldn't seem to be create so much damage." I think
a Simcoe seems, of course, Stadio's site. A Simcoe seems to be like that too.
Yeah. I'll add one other site. I think does comments well. Ars Technica. Maybe because the topics are a little esoteric. I mean, they write about fiber broadband and patents and things, but they have a lot of smart people, and the authors participate, and they seem to do okay. And one other place is TechDirt. Mike Masnick is still a big proponent of having commenters and still thinks it works. But otherwise, I think overall it's moving the other direction, and people are going the way of the verge.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Well, we're going to come back and talk about Facebook and some of the things that they're up to. They're definitely out to get Google one way or the other, and we'll be talking about that. But first, let's talk about Audible.com. Now, I have been an Audible user since the year 2000. And in fact, on one of the last shows where Regis and Kathy Lee shows in the year 2000 that Kathy Lee was still on the show, I actually came on that show and demonstrated Audible. Back then, it was a physical device because this is before the big iPod revolution, before the smartphone revolution, before any of that. They actually had to make a player so you could listen to books. And since then, they've gotten better and better and better. And one of the things that Audible has gotten so great at is the actors and the voice professionals who read many of these books, or better still, the authors sometimes read the books, and they are fantastic. Let me give you an example of something. One of the most popular, especially on BitTorrent, TV shows is, of course, Game of Thrones. Okay, Game of Thrones is just like anything else that goes from a book to television. It loses a lot. The actual book is wonderful, and Audible.com is a great way to consume that book. Can we listen to this and hear what it sounds like?
The Song of Ice and Fire by George R. R. Martin, read by Roy Dotrice.
Even his name sounds good when he reads it. That's unbelievable. Now, that is Roy Dotrice, who's doing the voice acting there, and it is great. Now, if you're one of these people who don't like the Game of Thrones because it's phony history, it's not really Europe, it's not really the Middle Ages, it's kind of they're drawing from those images and so on. If you want the real thing, try Richard III and the Ultimate Game for the Throne by C. Derbyshire, and this is narrated by Daniel Penz. This is actually references the Game of Thrones because a lot of the kinds of machinations and cutthroat contests for power during the reign of Richard III, of course, are just like, a lot like the TV show, but this is the real deal. Let's listen to a little bit of this.
Was the throne of England. The game was harsh, and it was brutal. Rival families went to war, leaving cousins dead on the battlefield. Brother fought brother as power corrupted and twisted men's souls.
See, now that sounds like entertainment. But that all that stuff really happens. Really, really good history. Now, I know that if you listen to Twit, probably with a smartphone, or you may watch it or whatever, you know the value of learning and getting content through the spoken word. Of course, books are stories. Fiction books are stories. And for the vast majority of human history, stories were an oral medium. People told stories. And since Gutenberg and literacy, we now get our stories primarily through books, but ultimately, human stories are supposed to be oral. At least originally, they were an oral medium. A storyteller told you stories. Homer, for example, we get Homer. You can read it now, but for centuries, Homer was just something that somebody told you from memory. And this brings you back to that magical experience of being told a story by a great storyteller. For those of you who need two audiobooks and to give Audible a try, today we're offering TWIT fans their Platinum Plan. This gives you two free audiobooks to try out and two book credits per month. It's a great deal for people who enjoy listening to audio programming. And as with other plans, you get a free subscription to the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times daily audio programs. You get to take your pick. And for more details and to get two free audiobooks and their Platinum offer, go to audible.com/twit2. That's audible.com/twit and the number 2. Gotta try audible.com if you haven't yet. Well, Facebook is up to something. They are obsessed with video these days, and I suspect that the main reason is that video advertising is very lucrative. They can make a lot of money off of video advertising, but they are apparently talking to the music companies, which started a rumor that they were going to get into a Apple Music type of service. They said that they are not building a streaming service. Okay, so that doesn't mean they're not getting into music. It doesn't mean a lot of things. What do you all suppose, Renee Ritchie, let's start with you. What do you think Facebook's up to here? Are they just trying to compete with YouTube, or are they intending to compete with Apple Music or with iTunes? What is their game here? What are they probably going toward?
It's amazing because historically a lot of people have likened first Microsoft and then Google to semi-drunken giants. And they meant by that you never knew where they're going to put their foot down next. And it might be firmly on top of your business because they were large, they were well-financed, and they were hyper-competitive. And Facebook really is like that because you seemingly can't tell from one minute to the next what they're going to do. Like Mark Zuckerberg really wants to make a phone, and then he wants to make an operating system layer, and then he doesn't want to do it anymore. And then he wants to make maps, and then there's no maps that come. And now you maybe wants to make music. And because you have such a character almost like Mark Zuckerberg, they really can spin on a whim and then choose where they want to go. And video has been really interesting because they had massive stats for video, but those videos were self-playing videos that as long as you scrolled down your timeline, you would see that video. And is that stat real? If someone watched it for 2 seconds as it flew by, I don't know. I don't know how it was reported. And then recently we heard about all the freebooting where people would just rip videos from YouTube, including famous people, put them up on Facebook, and they'd become viral completely away from the content creators. So it is not at all hard to believe that they might want to get into some sort of more formal arrangement for these videos, especially if they're forced to be as protective about content and content rights holders as YouTube has become. But again, I don't know if a month from now they'll decide that something else is the most important thing in the world. And I think that's part of what makes them both scary and fascinating.
Fascinating to all of us and scary for anyone who tries to compete with them. Now, there's an interesting element to this. Of course, they boosted video. I mentioned that they're obsessed with video. They've done that mainly by just tweaking their algorithm and making videos more likely to show up in people's news feeds. Of course, the majority of the stuff that people post, your family and friends post, if you leave all the defaults on, you're not ever going to see those in your news feed. They're available to you, and yes, you can change the news feed, but that's one of the ways they've boosted videos, just by making videos show up in your news feed more.
Well, native Facebook videos, and then I think they down-prioritize links to YouTube and competing services.
Yeah, yes, and they can just do that stuff. Yeah. Of course, algorithms are secrets. They don't have to explain what they've done. They can just do these things, but Facebook actually did something great and welcome and also surprising, which is that they added user controls for the news feed that enable anybody to get a lot more control over the news feed. Why do you suppose they're doing this, Andy and Otko? This seems uncharacteristic of Facebook to do something like this that seems to kind of harm their control of what people see in their news feeds. But it does, in fact, benefit users. Why do they do this?
Because the newsfeed is their one product, and you can't put poison down your one well. And I think that it sort of anticipates moves they've made. It echoes moves they've made in the past year and maybe anticipates moves they're about to make, that they're about to use that newsfeed for all kinds of new kinds of content and new kinds of partner agreements and new kinds of discoverability. I believe Zuckerberg and Facebook when they say that they have no immediate plans to create a streaming music service, but that doesn't mean they're not talking to labels about ways for them to insert, I wouldn't say ads, but discoverability for heavily marketed new tracks and albums into other people's news feeds. And so they realize that once that news feed becomes just this unrelenting conveyor belt of crap interspersed with pictures of your mom's new cat, that's when people start leaving Facebook and start going to other services. So I think that they're going to need to give users more control over what appears in that newsfeed to make sure that that newsfeed continues to be a really good central landing point for all of their users to start start using the internet. And that really is what Facebook is all about to the people who use it. It is that centralized dashboard that will give them a collected sort of feed of all the things that they're interested in, not just news stuff, but again, their personal relationships, private conversations and stuff like that. So it makes sense for them to want to preserve the integrity of that for their users. It is one of those Apple moves where let's make a move that is very much for our users, but also benefits us in the long run.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I don't know about you guys, but I hate it when a big company buys another big company that makes products that are beloved by some people, and then they shut it down, or they wind it down, or they hide it, or they do something like that. Yahoo does this a lot. Lots of companies do this. It looks like Microsoft is kind of sort of doing that with the phone business that they bought from Nokia. What is going on at Microsoft? Why are they sort of de-emphasizing their phone hardware business?
But hang on, Mike. You're not saying you love Nokia, are you?
No, I'm not, but a lot of people do, and a lot of Finnish people do, and you know, this is a company with great technology. They just happen to not be Apple or Google, and anybody in the smartphone business who isn't Apple or Google is not going to have an easy time competing with Apple and Google. But Jeff, people had a lot of high hopes, and everybody said, you know, hey, if they would just come out with some innovative, high-end, flagship smartphone hardware, they could start to creep up and actually become a player, but it looks like they're kind of backing off.
Yeah, I mean, they gave a good run at it, and I'd like to hear from the other guys what they think. Did they even have a chance? Because some school of thoughts were like, Palmer had to do this. It was mobile, you could build it, or you can acquire it. Acquire it was faster, and they gave it a good shot, but it just didn't work. Why was that? Could Microsoft have done it different? Is there any way Microsoft could have made a phone entry? Was it bad execution, or is it something they just never could have done in the first place?
I
wonder if this isn't a cookie that they waved towards other handset manufacturers, because the more you look at what Microsoft has planned for 2015 and beyond, they really are going all in on this. There is no difference between all of our platforms. There is one thing called Windows, and it runs on whatever screen you happen to have in front of you, whether it is a phone, whether it is a desktop, or anything in between. To the extent where they're encouraging developers to write this one app that will rearticulate itself depending on what piece of hardware it finds itself on at one given time. And that could be a really incredible twist to computing. Apple famously has, you know, made the comments about, you know, we're not making toaster fridges, and we're making pickup trucks, and we're making cars, and we're making different things for that they're tailored for different experiences. But if you're looking at a user base that isn't necessarily a huge fan of any one operating system, they just want a phone that does good things, and you say, well, here, try this. It costs $149, and basically all the software that you're running on your laptop right now also runs on this, and you never have to worry about where your data is or whether you can use it on this device. That could be really, really compelling. And there might have been a time where they had to own a handset manufacturer to get anybody to make a Windows phone hardware. Maybe it's more valuable for them to say, look, we are not going to, if you, HTC, Samsung, all of you guys, LG, if you want to try to make we are not going to be competing with you in the handset market. Please just make stuff that will support Windows. And that could be a win-win for both companies.
I don't think this is, just personally, I don't think this is any surprise. I think Microsoft was one of those companies where their success hid massive problems within their organization. And we've sort of seen that now. They were almost, you know, criminally is the wrong word, but they were blatantly, terribly bad about entering mobile. I was a big Windows Mobile user. I think the Trio Pro was the last Windows Mobile user I had. And I had, at one point, I had Windows PCs, I had an Xbox, I had the via Trio Pro, and none of these could talk to each other. There was no integration. Bill Gates made those famous speeches at CES about how wonderful it would be to put your phone down, it would take over your computer. It was fantasy. They were never able as a company to execute on any of those things. It took Apple and Google, you know, a while to do it themselves, but they did it before Microsoft. I could get fully functional Office on my iPad before I could get it on any of Microsoft's mobile products. And you can blame Steve Ballmer for this. I certainly would. I don't think buying Nokia did them any benefit. They devalued that company extensively before they bought it. And it just looks like they were completely inept at embracing mobile. And I don't think you can recover from that. I'm not sure as a company, I'm sure they have tons of money. It's not like HTC or like Palm was, or like BlackBerry was, where they have no ancillary products to help see them through difficult times in mobile. But it's hard to see any good resolution for this. When they did finally get their act together, it was years too late, and it was with products that were just not compelling enough to take on companies that entered mobile way after they did. And if I sound hugely disappointed, I am, because I went to Apple because Microsoft just didn't do anything. And I would not be at Apple today if they'd had their act together earlier.
Yeah.
Bad Microsoft. It's bad.
Yeah, it's also smart that I hope that their plan was never to be a big success on the level of Apple in selling phones, because that's never going to happen. You can't build your career saying that I'm going to be the Beatles, because there is already the Beatles, and there was a specific set of circumstances that allowed the Beatles to become the Beatles. What you have to do is figure out what your skills are, what your own predilections are, and play to those strengths. Microsoft, just like Renee said, I mean, they finally found their car keys about 4 years ago. I mean, they just been fumbling. They spent 10 years just like patting down pockets and then checking the jacket in their closet. They already checked 14 different times before coming out with any sort of a strategy for creating operating systems and software and services that were really, really relevant in a post iPhone world. They finally figured it out. They figured out that they need to get rid of Ballmer, for one thing. But after that, I think that they're on a right track now. The things that I've seen about Windows 10, I've been using Windows 10 for a while. I think that they've got a lot going on that Apple is missing out on, believe it or not. But it's all about if they can actually execute this great, great plan. It would be the first time they've actually done it. But again, I think they found the car keys 3 or 4 years ago. So now for the first time, I don't feel like I'm an idiot for thinking that Microsoft might be finally able to do something smart with phones. And I hope that if they are getting rid of Nokia the same way that Google got rid of Motorola, or at least the phone arm of Motorola. I hope that it's for the reason of trying to enhance more people to manufacture hardware that supports this new vision that they have.
Yeah, so do I. I mean, I think the real problem is that if you go down the laundry list of super hot mainstream platforms, there isn't a lot there. I mean, you know, IDC just announced this week that the PC business has declined 11.8%. Mm-hmm. This is a continuation of a decline that's been going on for a long time, but that's a huge drop. Gartner reported 9.5%, but they're actually counting high-end tablets as PCs. You look at the tablet market, everybody's even the iPad is not doing what people think it should be doing. In general, people buy one and that's it. They don't have to upgrade. They don't feel any pressure to upgrade every 2 years or whatever. Even Apple in the smartwatch business, we're hearing reports that the Apple Watch is not selling as they had hoped. And the only category that's just exploding and it continues without a sign of abatement is the smartphone business. Now, again, this isn't necessarily Microsoft doesn't necessarily have to be in the handset hardware business, but they really need to be major. They really should be in the hot business. Where else can Microsoft succeed? Is it in, you know, the future of Xbox? Is it the future of HoloLens? Is it the future of the hub, the Surface Hub device, which, by the way, is fantastic. It's a fantastic product. They're just not going to sell a lot of them because, you know, it's not a mainstream consumer product. Where is this going? Jeff, let's go to you. What do you think Microsoft's best bet is to become what they were historically, which is a behemoth that's, you know, sort of, you know, an industry leader driving a platform or two?
Well, let's start with one thing that's really struck me is that Microsoft is interesting again. We didn't talk about Microsoft the last couple of years. It was just sort of a joke over on the side as it milked Windows, and then we thought it'd slowly go away. But it seems lately they're making some bets. Will it work or not? I don't know. But as Andy said, they found their keys, And now let's see what they do. As for Way Out, I don't know. Xbox always seems like the one kind of, not a crown jewel, but it's the one product I like and everyone likes. I hate Windows. My new job, I have to use Outlook, and it's deplorable. So, but what they're going to do next, I don't know. My colleague Barb Darrow says they're betting on cloud, but is there room for them to get in there? I don't know, but let's just start with the fact that Microsoft seems interesting, and I'm not sure about relevant, but they're certainly there. Don't count them out.
Yeah, I have a hard time seeing it. And just to go back for a second, the Apple Watch is interesting to me because those numbers that were reported were not well reported. And it's Apple never announced figures for what they wanted. But my understanding is when you look at the wearables market and you look at what the Apple Watch has sold, it's done really well for that kind of technology. And it'd be interesting to see it compared to other entry-level products and other products that spike during a sales season and go down. But I think a lot, same with the iPad, though the iPad is not selling as well as it used to be, a lot of companies would give their eye teeth for a business as profitable of that. And my guess is Apple Watch is extremely profitable right now too. And that's the problem with things like Microsoft and even things when you look at Android, huge, huge platform, but you go back to those profitability figures and Apple's eating 92% of that profit. And what can a company like Microsoft do to be profitable? Because as a people, we're increasingly saying that software and services have no value to us. We'd want them if they're free and we'll do very little else beyond that. So what position companies like HTC and companies like Motorola and companies like Nokia / Microsoft can do to survive and to be viable products in their own right, it's really difficult to see. And even if you think they're taking bold bets with things like HoloLens or they're going all to the cloud, maybe that's an IBM business eventually where they're a huge company that nobody really thinks too much about because their infrastructure and backbone and Azure is feeding iCloud or something else like that. Really, really hard to see. I will weep if that happens because I want a highly competitive environment. I'm weeping right now for BlackBerry. You know, maybe they were interesting when they announced the Passport, but as time goes on, you start to see what happens to these companies. The bold bets they make, they don't pay off anymore, and they start to make sort of, like Andy said, they find their car keys, but maybe at a time when we no longer use cars that much. So my greater concern for Microsoft is whether they are, as a culture, able to make great products again, whether that product is cloud computing or that product is a phone, because corporate culture really matters. We're seeing that as one of the driving forces behind success these days. And Satya Nadella is doing an amazing transformation, but it is enough fast enough? I don't know.
Renee, do you have any predictions or advice for BlackBerry?
So, I'm nobody. I can't give them any advice or predictions at all. I mourn as a Canadian who lost Nortel and lost Corel and lost 3DFX and a lot of other great Canadian companies.
Oh, was Corel such a big loss, really?
I mean, very few countries have sort of the technology industry. Very few countries made major mobile operating systems. You know, the U.S. has Android and iOS, but there's just not that many countries that do it. And it's sort of a point of pride that Canada had first the J2ME that ran BlackBerry and then QNX. And unfortunately, it looks like BlackBerry might take QNX down with them, yet to be determined. I don't know. They're going all in on enterprise, and they're making a couple of new devices like the Classic and I forget what the other one is coming after that. And maybe they're making an Android phone now. But like Microsoft, I don't know if it's too little too late. And unlike Samsung and unlike Microsoft, they don't have massive ancillary businesses to drop profits on to keep them going in the interim. So I'm sadly not optimistic.
Well, I gotta say that for profitability, no one can touch Apple. They are fantastic at generating money. There's just no one who can even touch them. But it has to be said that they're able to do that because there's a company like Microsoft that is serving the needs of closer to 90% of all desktop users in the world. There are things that Apple is unwilling, or let's also confront the idea that they are also maybe unable to do, which is to sell computers for the entire world, not just the people with money. The entire market share of macOS and macOS and Linux combined is one half the market share of Windows XP. That's how tiny the user base of macOS is. Same thing for the iPhone, where Apple is either unable or unwilling, or maybe even again unable to create phones that the entire world can use. They're able to have the business that they have because there are other people who have the responsibility for putting a phone in the hands of everybody who needs or wants a phone. They just want the people who have money. So this is good for Apple because this not just for, you know, money. We all like money, but that gives us them the ability to experiment more, take bigger risks, have bigger failures that they can absorb via cushion. But let's not pretend that Microsoft is not providing a valuable service for the entire world with their products. Again, they are the gears and the grease that runs business and that runs worldwide computing. Again, Apple, they don't want that business or they don't care about that business. So I just don't like it when I don't think that Renee was taking the discussion in that direction. But whenever we talk about this in general, we have to say that, again, if we were to have a magic wand and make Microsoft disappear, and now Apple is forced to compete, where people come into the store, say that, well, I've got $500 to spend on a desktop. What can you sell me? And what you can sell me is, here's how much time we put calculating the proper chamfer angle of our $1,300 computer. It's like they're going to find that they're going to have to start making less expensive computers. They're going to have to start making computers that that user in Pakistan and that user in India is going to make sense for them. And again, they have not demonstrated that they have the ability and the knowledge to actually build a computer like that. They show me an iPhone 6 and I'm dazzled, but I'm also dazzled by a Raspberry Pi. And yeah. I think they're both on the exact same footing in terms of what's really, really an impressive achievement in computer engineering.
See, I think you're absolutely right, and I agree with you 100%. My only thing with where I was going with that is there are some companies, and I loved WebOS, I loved Palm, I loved Nokia. People were streaming live from the N95 long before they were using Meerkat or Periscope or anything. But I think a lot of companies thought that after Apple and after Google, they would be the de facto. They could basically, there was a right to be the third place participant in this category, and it turned out that Android was both first place and third place, whether that's different carrier, different manufacturer, Android open source project. Chinese Android, whatever you want to label it, there was no divine right to third place. And Microsoft, like BlackBerry raced it a year on the playbook that and didn't make phones. Microsoft made the Surface and tried to advertise it against the iPad and then awkwardly against the MacBook Air without changing the copy that said, hey, we have USB ports. And that sort of stuff is just not good for us as an industry. And I wish Microsoft was better at it because I don't want the choice to be between two different Googles or, you know, different versions of Android. I'd rather we have better, more robust competition.
And just a correction, Andy, you said that if somebody walked into the Apple store and said they wanted to buy a $500 computer and that implied that Apple doesn't have a solution. Of course they do. Their cheapest wristwatch would be what they would sell you.
Mac Mini, iPad.
Right, exactly. This is a far better than this.
You're gonna have a hard time writing your term paper on Apple Watch. and the fact that it's going to spend every keystroke 10 seconds communicating back to the phone and then getting the keystroke back again, that also is going to... You're going to have to get a late... take the letter grade down for being late for that.
Well, we've got some more stories coming up in just a second. But first, let's talk about mobile payments. Let's talk about Braintree, one of our sponsors today. If you're a mobile app developer, check out Braintree. Braintree is the payment solution used by companies like Uber, Airbnb, Hotel Tonight, Living Social, and Munchery. You have already used Braintree if you've used any of those services. Now, developers must believe in a product, and Juan Benitez, the CTO of Braintree, talked to us recently about the feedback he gets from developers. Let's check that out.
You know, when we talk to iOS engineers, they get really excited by how fast and easy it is to have Apple Pay through Braintree. Just a ton of feedback from Android developers saying, wow, great, now I can get Android Pay. Then you see people really kind of responding and saying, wow, I can do more than one of these through one integration, one SDK, and one report too. Wow, that's going to make my finance guys happy.
Braintree has made the payment experiences in these apps seamless and magical. And now you can add a similar experience to your own app. With excellent customer service and simple integration, Braintree gets you ready to receive payments quickly. And Braintree's continuous support plus fast payouts means you'll be prepared as your company grows from your first dollar to your billionth dollar. There's some optimism for you. Braintree is helping solve the problem of mobile cart abandonment. Also, huge problem if you've got a shopping cart on mobile, by offering best-in-class mobile checkout experience. The reason people wander away is they get confused or it takes too long or it's too involved. Not with Braintree. It's so easy for them to get to the end, and they will buy your product or service because Braintree makes it so fast and easy. So Braintree gives you a full-stack payment solution, support for all payment types that your customers might want. You can accept PayPal, Apple Pay, Bitcoin, Venmo, credit cards, and a lot more, all with a single integration across all platforms with superior fraud protection, very important, superior customer service, and very fast payouts. So learn more, and for your first $50,000 in transactions fee-free, go to braintreepayments.com/twit. We thank them for their support of Twit. Well, Jason, you've got some John C. Dvorak calls house ads. Let's find out what happened here on Twit in the past week.
Previously on Twit.
How did we stumble into this?
Tech news today.
Trading was temporarily stopped on the New York Stock Exchange floor today because of some technical issues. Also, United Airlines grounded all flights today for about 2 hours after experiencing what the company said was a network connectivity issue.
From what we're hearing from the NYSE, they're not related at all, and they're not cyber attacks. I did tell the NYSE to reboot that Raspberry Pi that they run everything on, but they didn't listen to me.
Yeah. iOS today.
So you had this excellent idea for us to get our craft on, make some DIY iPhone and iPad cases. So
I think I did it.
Ta-da!
This week in Google.
Google has this software that will make images, and the end result is pure, unfiltered LSD. This is closer to how the human mind actually works.
I mean, hey, Jason, can you call the guys in the white coats for Mike if this is how his brain works?
Twit. Some assembly required.
All right. Great material there. I don't know what Padre and those guys were doing at the beginning. Wow. Great stuff. Well, gentlemen, Jawbone is suing Fitbit. This is the third lawsuit in a while. This one in particular is being filed with the International Trade Commission. And what they're trying to do is block Fitbit from importing fitness trackers or even the parts to those fitness trackers, because what they're claiming is that employees were poached. Jawbone employees were poached by Fitbit. Those employees stole proprietary company secrets. They brought them over to Fitbit, and then Fitbit productized them. Jeff, is this, from what you understand, does this case have merit? Does that whole argument have any merit? Do we have enough information to even know that?
What this screams to me is that Jawbone is losing to Fitbit. You only start pulling these sort of tactics out when you're losing. The factors, the ITC and the patent lawsuit, I mean, those two always go together. If you're suing in one, you can sue in the other automatically. So I would just read this whole story as simply being Jawbone's a loser in the business stuff. And so they're pulling out the dirty IP tricks. That's my take on it. I mean,
all right.
You might think that elsewise.
Any thoughts, Andy?
No, I mean, exactly what Jeff said. I mean, you don't. I've been reading about this lawsuit, and it doesn't seem as though Fitbit is doing anything that other companies have not done without any attraction of lawsuits. I think the big problem is that they are making money and making products that people find relevant. Rest Job, Jawbone is the Christmas present that a kid opens excited until he sees the logo is not the Fitbit logo. That's what Jawbone is right now.
Yeah, the only thing I can add to this is that, again, we look at companies often and we forget that they're made up of human beings, and human beings do not take losing very well. And it's very easy. And sometimes there's even merit to it to believe that a company has unfairly won a market or is winning, for an unrighteous reason. And then the human response to that is, we'll go get them. And that often manifests in business as a lawsuit. So there could be people very well inside Jawbone who truly believe to the depth of their being that they have been badly done by, and this is a recourse they're doing, and whether or not that has any basis on realities, up to anyone to choose.
Hmm. Well, shifting gears a little bit, it appears increasingly like the Internet of Things is becoming mainstream. On my way in today, I was listening to Pandora. I don't have the ad-free version. I have the advertising version. There was an ad for IBM's Internet of Things platform. It was kind of vague, but still on Pandora. So I thought, and on the Green Day channel too. So it's becoming more mainstream. And another example of that, I think probably even the best example, is that Target has opened it's an Apple store, essentially, where they have all kinds of Internet of Things devices displayed, not in techie, geeky, sort of like Radio Shack kind of way, but again, in a very consumer-friendly, warm and fuzzy Apple store kind of way, where it's like, look at all this fun stuff for the Internet of Things. Is this a good strategy for Target? What do you suppose they hope to gain from this? I'll throw that open to anybody who wants to jump on it.
It's a tough thing to sell to people, isn't it? I mean, you have to, there's so many devices that are on sale in the past year and a half that simply did not exist 2 years ago. And we're talking about smartwatches, we're talking about smart light bulbs, we're talking about thermostats, things like that, that people did not grow up around and they don't have an existing use for. So what they have to do is the stores have to do a lot more aggressive or a lot more hand-holding to say, here is why you would want to spend double the amount of money for an LED bulb than for the ones you can get at Home Depot. Here's why you want to spend this astronomical amount of money for a Nest thermostat. And here's why this wristwatch that won't even tell you the time until you actually do something to shake it and wake it up is much better than the watch that you have on right now that your grandfather gave you. And so you do need these active demo areas. And that's particularly going to be true of Target. People come into an Apple store with a fundamental knowledge of technology or with a desire to know. People come into Target because they ran out of salad dressing. So to have this sort of a better outreach, to be a warm, friendly environment, clean with everything running and no fingerprints on them, that's just smart for Target.
And I'll add to what Andy, I agree with Andy completely, and you know, I'm saying that a lot because it's true. But I think at 50 years from now, 20 years from now, all our stuff will just be smart. But we're in the period of transition, the turbulence. And to get from there to here, from here to there, people are going to have to go through a process. Now, things like Target is an approach to try and ease us into that process because things are going to be more difficult and more confusing and more expensive over the short term. But in a few years from now, you're just going to get things with chipsets and radios in it. It's just going to be the way that things are, sort of like how now we have things that have electricity in them that may not have used to have them. And Target is probably doing a smart thing because the worst thing that could happen is that some other company gets the early adopter wave where there's a lot more money and a lot more interest to be made. So I think things like this are great. Whether Target is the best approach, who knows? Amazon's going to do something. And again, 5 years from now, we'll all be using our Hue light bulbs or whatever light bulbs we have.
You know, everybody talks about the Internet of Things, and you're absolutely right. Everything's going to have a chip. Everything's going to have a radio. Everything will be potentially able to connect. But I feel like this is just a train coming down the track, a train wreck coming down the track, really, because I don't see this segment of the industry doing anything to solve the problem of multiple incompatible platforms on multiple levels. And I don't see any dominant players. I don't see any sort of agreement. I don't see enough of those sort of cabals that they form around standards and so on.
Brillo, Mike, Brillo.
Yeah, right, exactly. So, I mean, Renee, if you were to go back in time, 15 years or 20 years or whatever, they would say, oh, in the future, you'll have all these devices attached to your TV and only one remote control. Everybody will have one remote to control everything. And of course, everybody's got a whole pile of remotes because the TV industry has not figured out the relatively simple solution to the problem of multiple incompatible TV remotes. And people are confused. They, you know, you go into your average house where they have a TV, you know, and a couple of devices plugged in, and they pick up the remote to do this. They figured out, they've learned through trial and error that if you pick up this remote and push this button, then you pick up the other remote to do the volume, and then you have to go. I mean, this is where TV remotes are at, and this is not an original thought. This is called the basket of remotes problem. But how is this industry going to get the Internet of Things to be an actual Internet of Things?
Just to illustrate that point, my mom has a Samsung TV and a Samsung cable box, and one does not fit under the other. And when the cable box is connected to the TV, the audio is out of sync. But when it's connected to the Apple TV, it works fine. And she's just a normal person and has no idea how to cope with any of these things, much less the three controls that came with two devices, because one has a flat surface and one has buttons. So I think that problem is absolutely right, and I apologize because I cut off.
Who did you cut off? Was that you, Jeff?
Jeff, sorry.
Yeah, no, Mike, I think that's really astute what you're saying, that Target can build it, but will they come? I think really grabby consumer stuff, people see their friends have it, and they want it too. I'm not sure you can educate people into taking it up. Yeah, the IoT is coming, and companies want people to adopt it, but you got to give consumers a use case. And as for the basket remote problem, I heard something insightful, which is that it's got to be something in your house already, and there's only three viable things. It's security systems, it's the cable company, or it's like the HVAC and your utilities in your house. And those are going to be the platforms, and someone's going to have to piggyback a standard and devices onto that. But simply coming in there and expecting a consumer to adopt it because you can and get a connected light bulb, I think that's sort of putting the cart before the horse. I think you need to establish a platform on a use case and some buzz, and then people will come. Simply putting it in Target is not going to work.
I think the smartphone or the mobile in general abstracts a lot of that away, though. And whether it's Apple's HomeKit or Brillo, hopefully it'll end up being sort of like Android Auto or CarPlay, or if there's third-party vendors like QNX or something, where it doesn't really matter to the person anymore. They just get into the car, and if they have Android, they have a great experience. If they have iOS, they have a great experience. As you start buying more of these things, right now I have Hue light bulbs and Sonos speakers and a couple other things, and they're not great because they're not compatible, but they're all just apps on my phone. So all I really need is my phone or my tablet, and now my watch a little bit to control them. And as things like Android's home automation takes off and HomeKit takes off, I'll have things like Siri or Google Now, and I'll just say, you know, Siri, crash the compound, or Google Now, game time. And a lot of it, I think, I hope, will sort of take care of itself, because these sorts of transitions are often matched by transitions in user interface that make things easier and typically more mainstream than ever before. And hopefully we're aligned enough where that those interface improvements will hit as the same time as things become more connected and smarter in general.
Yeah, you also have to sell it to the right people. I'll never forget the time when at my mom and dad's house, I would come over and I'd set up the Christmas decorations. And I remember the first time that I decided that my folks, they had like those little like window candles in every single one of the street facing windows. And I remember the first time that I bought a whole bunch of X10 controllers, and I showed my mom that now at when you want to turn on the lights, all I have to do is push this one button that I left like on the end table, and the Christmas tree lights will come on and the window lights will come on. And she's like, oh my God, that's so wonderful. That's so much time. Say, oh, how'd you do that? And then like, okay. So now that the local anesthetic has taken effect, let's see if she'll go for the real one. It's like, now, Mom, with this, I could also plug in this other box that would turn them on and off automatically at the same time every day. And that was going to cause a fire, and she wanted nothing to do with it. So there are times when there are people who love the demo. They would love to attend like the 1962 World's Fair and see the push button House of Tomorrow, but they don't want to have the push button House of Tomorrow. People don't know that their Apple TV can actually learn how to use whatever remote you're using for your other TV. But it's simpler and more direct to simply say, here is the thing that is shaped like an Apple TV remote. I know that this is what controls the Apple TV. Here's the thing that's shaped like my cable box remote. I know that this is the thing that controls the cable box. So it's not an easy problem to solve. And I think that it won't start to get solved until people a year from now, 2 years from now, can be told that, oh, well, do you have an Apple TV? Yeah, I bought one last year. Well, that has everything you need to do this except for the light bulb. So if you want to spend another $4 for this light bulb, it can do things like make sure that the front light is always on at sundown and always gets turned off at 11 p.m. Is that worth an extra $3 or $4 to you? And that's when you get the extra $3 or $4 from them.
And plus you'll get a lot of fires. I'm with your mom on that. So one last thing on this, kind of, sort of like the Internet of Things, I guess, things that are in your house. I got an Amazon Echo for Father's Day, and I've also reviewed it, so I was familiar with it well before I got it. But I love this thing. I think it's a brilliant plan on the part of Amazon for a number of reasons, one of which, of course, is that it's a machine that facilitates buying things from Amazon. It's also great because they've got third-party integration. So, for example, you can listen to, and I won't say the whole comment, because those of you out there who have an Amazon Echo, I don't want to have it change the channel on you or start talking. But basically, you can listen to Twit live on TuneIn Radio just by talking. You just say, you know, just give the command. It's the fact that it's an appliance that is high quality. The speaker is very high quality. The microphone is very high quality. I have it in the kitchen, and I can talk to it from the bedroom, and I can hear its response and everything. I mean, it's just great. Why didn't Apple think of this? Why didn't Google think of this? Why is Amazon the company that's essentially building the virtual assistant appliance of the future? Anyone?
They have a crazy billionaire CEO, which is always helpful. Sometimes. I mean, the reason why the Amazon Fire Phone happened was because the crazy billionaire CEO was the person who's deciding that's the product they want to make. But it's also the crazy billionaire CEO who also decided, I want to make spaceships, and now he's also making spaceships. I don't know what Jeff Bezos' area of involvement was in Alexa, but I would not be surprised if it was another, when this sounds like an interesting idea, let's go make this. And I'm with you 100%. I mean, it's clear that Google and Apple are missing a big trick here. The fact that you have a very powerful omnidirectional microphone that can be reached from several rooms, so that I thought that it was a big convenience when I got the Moto 360 and when I got the Apple Watch to be able to like set a kitchen timer just by doing this and speaking some words. But the ability to simply, as I'm closing the door to the oven on the chicken that's going to take about 25 minutes to cook, to simply say, Alexa, set a timer for 20 minutes. And I'm not even thinking about it. I'm not even looking at it. But 20 minutes later, I'm going to get an alert. It is so and it would be so simple if Apple just produced even a $99 box exactly like this that was nothing but a really good microphone that gives us access to Siri from wherever the speaking voice works. That would so amplify the power of that feature immensely. I think it was a little bit like Google Glass. I had to actually have it in the house and be using it to realize that, they've got something here. They really got something here.
But my theory is that Apple is not ever going to get into this business. I think they will enable the Apple TV or the future of Apple TV to do this sort of functionality. But the problem is that a product like this is software upgradable. So, for example, once you buy an Amazon Echo, you never need to upgrade it. They will improve it in the cloud, the software, the algorithms, the servers, all that stuff is how you improve it. You won't need a better speaker in the future. You won't need a better microphone unless it breaks. You only need to buy one, and that is not an Apple-style business. That's one of the problems they're having with the iPad, which is that you really only need one, and it's going to be perfectly good for years.
The thing about, if I can defend Apple and Google for a minute here, is that they are operating differently than Amazon. It's sort of like, why did Amazon have better screens in their tablets before Apple or Google? Well, you can have these better screens when you're making five. When you're making 500 million, it's much harder to make those kinds of screens. And Amazon as a company is interesting to me because I'm outside the U.S. And Amazon is one of those companies where I think it's incredibly U.S.-centric, the kind of coverage they get. It's like, I just looked at Amazon.ca. There's no Echo there. There's no MP3 here. Amazon Prime here is just about deliveries. The amount of services they offer outside the U.S. is incredibly small. And that allows them a huge amount of flexibility. If you're making a phone for one country, if you're making a device like this for one country, the needs you have to serve are much, much smaller. Now, Google and Apple absolutely have these products. Apple is looking at this differently. They're looking at it in an Apple way. Like you said, a next generation Apple TV that has Siri built in. Maybe it's not just a box that does it, but it's a box that does it while it does HomeKit, like for the Internet of Things, and while it does television services. It, by the way, also has this functionality that you can access by Siri. And Google's had many different home initiatives and likely will have more. And Google Now is a mainstay of their services. So it's almost certain that eventually you'll have the Google Now box, whether it's bundled in your TV or into your refrigerator or your dishwasher or who knows. But when you're making that product that's international, that has to serve all sorts of different languages and interests, and different services that are bundled into it, it is a much harder problem to solve. Now, maybe the Apple TV should have shipped 2 years ago, but they're waiting on, you know, content deals or something else. And maybe Google's trying several different things to try and get it right. But we will absolutely see it. I just think that judging Apple or Google by the same sort of strategy that Amazon employs is only really relevant in the U.S. right now.
Well, okay. But the thing is, Apple is capable of doing anything they want to do. There is no problem they cannot solve. There is no product that if they think it's important for them to make, they cannot ship. They're making a $10,000 damn gadget watch. That's
internationally, Andy. You can get it in China.
Okay, well, they're certainly not selling them to people in India. But I don't think that it's a lack of creativity or anything like that. I do think that this feels like a small potatoes device for Apple. It's the same reason why they haven't done an improvement upon their wireless keyboard since version 1.0 of this thing, despite the fact that the iPad is the utility of the iPad opens up immensely once you pair it with a decent Bluetooth keyboard. I mean, I would love to, if the rumors of Apple doing an iPad Pro come to fruition later this year, I would love nothing more than for them to introduce the iPad Pro alongside. And by the way, we've made a keyboard that we think shows you exactly how much you can do with our $500 iPad Air 3 or iPad Pro or whatever you're going to call it. I just think that the reason why they're not going to make a device like this is because they don't, they're not intrinsically an accessories sort of company. They are a 20 minutes in the keynote with a video of people talking about, again, chamfer angles and material choices. And you can't really do, it's got a microphone and, it's got a wall adapter so you can plug it into your wall.
It's made out of aluminium, Andy. So is there anything else you guys want to talk about before we wrap this thing up? I'll throw that open if anybody has anything. Silence.
Not really. Apple Music is still hit or miss for me. I'm liking it more, but it's highs and lows for me. I did back up absolutely everything in my library, copied it to a hard drive, then unplugged that hard drive before upgrading to the new iTunes. And it seems to have been a really good transition for me so far. But it's like it really is like moving into a new house where immediately you, oh my God, there's so much light in the living room. We're going to have coffee in the living room all the time now. And then you realize, oh, so I can't run the shower and the dishwasher at the same time. That's new, isn't that?
You know, since you brought up Apple Music, I have to say that, and I think that I'm sure that we've been in this conversation together at some point as Apple was rolling this thing out. But I had been very bullish on Kinect, the Kinect feature, and very down on BBC One, yeah, Beats One Music.
Very common mistake.
Yeah, it's not hard to do.
Always on.
They Samsung BBC. Let's just go and say that Apple has Samsung BBC One.
Exactly. We did eventually learn to stop saying iWatch, so there's hope. but of course, now my opinion is been reversed. It Kinect just seems like a non-starter, and Beats One seems brilliant to me. Brilliant because essentially they have this global radio station. It's a rare event it's a rare medium where you can have this global shared experience that's not an event. So, for example, yeah, when there's the World Cup or the Oscars or something like that, yeah, the whole world is kind of experiencing a single event. But this is the only medium that I'm aware of where a critical mass of people, lots and lots and lots of people, are all listening to the same thing more or less at the same time. That's its main value to me. Plus, you know, the curation is very, very skillfully done. And it's a fantastic marketing tool for Apple to drive people into the paid services around music and so on. And so I just think Beats One is absolutely brilliant. My question to you guys is, maybe you know, why are they selling ads on it and why aren't they fully live 24/7? Andy, you were just saying that, you know, Apple can do anything. They have very deep pockets. It seems like the super home run here would have been 24/7 live radio and no ads. Why didn't they do that?
I think because every time they talk about competing music streaming services, a lot of the deep cuts inside that interview is, that's nice, but how are they making money? They're as deep pocketed as they are. They're not going to simply run Apple Music as a conservancy. They have to make sure that it makes money each and every time. They have to have a sustainable model for everything. I don't understand anything about the music business deeper than that, but I suspect that it really is about, we have to make this a self-supporting service. We can't just simply be shoveling money into it year after year after year, because that's not a business. That's just simply that's a vanity project. That is indeed running it like a hobby.
Well, that is Apple's thing, where they make money after. They're not into like the Amazon model, where you lose money over here so you can make it up elsewhere. They want to make money at every single point, the content, that, you know, all of it. But it, still, there's lots of money to be made in driving Beats One listeners, which is free, you know, to the paid version of Apple Music. That's got to be the far more lucrative than the, you know, Bank of America ads.
I think it's also like Apple doesn't have profit and loss across divisions the way some company does. And for example, the chipsets, you never hear about how much money a chipset makes at Apple, like the A8X or something, because it's not relevant. They don't have to sell that chipset to anybody but Apple. So you could have a model inside Apple where they decide that this is such a core technology that they're just going to pay for it and not, you know, and enjoy the benefits of that in other parts of the business. But I think it's much more realistic than that. Apple, there's not that many Zane Lowe's. Like, maybe Apple could hire a bunch more DJs. But at a certain point, you want, this is like an artistic endeavor for them in some ways. That sounds corny, but they really want people like Zane Lowe who are almost like appointment listening. You want these amazing DJs on there, and you want to have few enough of them that people can identify it, that they're waiting, that they're interested in what these people have to say. And if you have enough of them to scale 24/7 immediately, that's sort of diluted. It's much better to sort of start small and introduce a couple big personalities and then build out from there. The ads are sort of like the way a radio sort of run. I guess maybe, you know, they can make it profitable, so why not? But I think the idea of having a few people to start off with is the kind of patience and restraint that Apple, because of their affluence, can really afford to take. And that is start slowly and ramp it up from there. And we talked about this on MacBreak. I'm wondering if we'll see Beats 2 Classic, Beats 3 Metal at some point, if this model proves lucrative enough for them.
I think the model is to not do that. I think the brilliant thing about this model is that there is one. And if they spin it off into multiple channels to try to satisfy multiple markets, I think they've lost what was great about it. Then they're just doing internet radio like everybody else. But to have the one single channel that every Apple enthusiast, you know, lots of people who want to be associated with the Apple brand, who like Zane Lowe, whatever, they're all listening to the same thing. I think that's the model. But that's just my opinion. I don't know what you guys think about
it. It's too Mandarin.
Yeah, it's too Mandarin. All right, well, let's wrap it up. Andy Iannocco is technology columnist for the Chicago Sun-Times and, of course, a host of MacBreak Weekly. He is the Zane Lowe of technology journalism. Thank you so much, Andy Iannocco, for spending a big chunk of your Sunday illuminating us all with your wisdom and wit.
Thank you so much, Mike. And next up, we're going to have another version of Accent of the Happy.
Very well done. Sorry,
That, that's not the right accent.
But no, it isn't. But
it's Sunday night.
We get the idea. Yes, it is. And Renee Ritchie, editor-in-chief of iMore and host of MacBreak Weekly and other things. Renee Ritchie, what are you guys working on these days?
Actually, we just recorded an episode of Debug. In light of all the Safari is a new IE thing, we got Don Melton on, who founded WebKit and Safari at Apple, and put him on with Jim Ray, formerly of Mule Design, but who does a lot of fancy web stuff. So they could sort of hash out what this whole internet thing is all about.
Oh,
so
yeah.
That should be out this week.
I've heard about the internet. That sounds great. And Jeff John Roberts he writes about law, culture, technology, and the intersection thereof for Fortune, formerly of GigaOm. If you recognize his name, you may recognize him from GigaOm. Jeff John Roberts, thank you so much for joining us today. And where can people find your work, and what are you working on these days?
Anything that starts with the letter P, patents, privacy, piracy. And you can find my writing and a great team of former GigaOmers at the tech vertical of Fortune. So come see us. And thanks for having me, Mike. It was a pleasure.
Thank you so much for coming on. If you want to see more Jeff, you'll see him on Tech News Today weekdays at 10 every time I can convince him to come on. So Leo and the gang do Twit every Sunday at 3 p.m. Pacific. You can subscribe to Twit and download past episodes by going to twit.tv/Twit. I want to thank you all for joining us today. I want to thank our wonderful audience here today for coming in. Leo will be back next time. He will be wearing Lederhosen. Ladenhosen? Lederhosen? How do you say it? Lederhosen. He's been in Germany. And so stick around for next week's Twit, because, again, Leo will be back. And with that, I say another Twit is in the can.